Reese Winterbourne.
Well, welcome to the club, Sarah.
What a perfect hero.
He is a perfect, I mean, I think.
Like, yeah. What?
Well, and I think, like, that's, like, part of me wants to be like, oh, it's so mysterious why everybody loves it. And then no, I'm like, no, it's
not
Reese
at
Winterbourne.
All mysterious. Yeah. It is 1,000,000%. This, like, I mean, he's perfect.
He's perfect, yeah. I think there's going to be a lot of things we're going to talk about. Maybe we should introduce ourselves and just get right to it, everybody. We're marrying Winterbourne this week on Fated Mates.
I mean, I wish. I wish I was married to Winterbourne. I mean, no, I mean, Eric's lovely.
I mean, you know what I think about a lot? Here's how I put Reese Winterbourne in his place. Look, back then he was something else, but now he's just Sears and Roebuck and nobody goes there anymore. Fine.
Okay, Jennifer.
Come on, that was funny.
All right.
That is the only way I will malign his name. Everything else I say will be nice.
God. Well, I would marry Sears and Roebuck if they acted this way, too. Together.
Obviously.
Welcome, everyone, to Fated Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I read romance novels and I write them.
And I'm Jennifer Prokop, a romance reader and editor. And this week, I've read a million times. Sarah read for the first time Marrying Winterbourne by the great Lisa Kleypas.
I opened the vault and I pulled out Marrying Winterbourne. And Reese Winterbourne is everyone's book boyfriend for a reason, you guys.
Yes.
If you were like, if you, like me, have been, you know, happily engaging with Twitter, with romance Twitter for the last however many years, and just thinking to yourself, there just is no way, there's no way this hero is this perfect.
Well, he's like Christian Grey without being super creepy.
No, he's a stop it.
Right?
Stop it.
No, I'm serious.
He is not at all like Christian Grey.
Well, he's like a billionaire magnate who gives Helen whatever she wants.
I mean, yeah, but he's also perfect.
Yeah, he's interesting and, you know, has like a... has a personality and a work ethic, so I understand. We actually see him at work all the time.
And he's not a cipher at all. He is just pure emotion.
Well, I think that's right. So let me confess something, everybody. I don't know if I've ever told anybody this. Now is the time. The first time I tried to read this book, I actually DNF'd it because I had not read Cold Hearted Rake. And it's interesting because Kleypas is really the queen of the secondary romance in a lot of ways, but it is unusual, I think, maybe I'm wrong, to have her essentially like tee up so much of a romance and then have the couple get their own whole book in the next book.
Right. So I vaulted Winterbourne because I had read Cold Hearted Rake, and the secondary romance is so terrific in that book. The tee up to this is just, I mean, it's so perfect that I was like, I have to vault this because I know it's going to be great.
So I started this book, you know, kind of cold and was like, what is going on? Right? Like, she shows up in his office and is asking for a new engagement ring and something. He had some very bad behavior, but he took care of her orchids. And I just remember being deeply confused about what the fuck was going on.
God, those orchids.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So should we talk about Cold Hearted Rake should we explain what happened in Cold Hearted Rake?
What's interesting to me about Lisa's writing in general, which is how absolutely fearless this woman is about a big, plotty set piece. I don't know what else to call it, right? So Winterbourne and Devon Ravenel are on their way back to Eversby Priory, and their train crashes.
Because of course it does.
Right?
I mean, because Lisa, nobody does it better, right?
Right. And I actually spent a lot of my time thinking about why these big – so anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. But Winterbourne is badly injured in the crash, and Helen kind of defaults to taking care of him. And the attraction between them is very sudden.
Nobody has ever shown Reese Winterbourne kindness.
Yeah.
For no reason other than to be kind.
Right, right. And so – and I think it's interesting, like, and Helen has never been able to, I think, show people what she's made of, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's just kind of this, like, calm, steady presence, but not someone who's, like, I don't know, good in a crisis, I guess. So these two kind of end up together, but they're really – he's a fish – like a fish out of water, right? He is interested in a highborn wife, just sort of enter into the final stage of – kind of the forbidden era of, you know, the forbidden zone of kind of the highborn British class, upper classes. Because he's, although he's the richest man in England, except for Tom Severin, he's still.
Except for Tom.
He's still just a, like a grocer, right, to them.
Well, and he's Welsh, which is important.
Yes.
Right? It comes up. This is, I mean, the entire plot of this book is basically Wales versus England.
Right. Very, very, I like it. I like it now more than ever, right?
Especially now, this week, you know, like post-Queen dying, where we know a lot about Wales versus England these days.
Yes.
And it felt like a good thing to read.
Yeah. So at the end, there's like a big, like breakup, essentially, right? He tries to kiss her, and she's overwhelmed or scared. And
this is at Cold Heart,
right? In Cold Heart, Kathleen goes and says, you know, she doesn't want anything to do with you, and kind of gets her medals maybe where she shouldn't have. And then, you know, it's sort of a few weeks later at the beginning of this book, and Helen has decided that a mistake was made, right? Like Kathleen spoke for her, but she shouldn't have, and they go out of town, and so. Helen sees her opportunity to go fix it.
But we are in Rhys's POV at the start of this book, and he is consumed by thoughts of her. She's not even there, and he's like, I can't stop thinking about this woman. And listen, he is not going to be able to stop thinking about this woman for 390 pages.
As it should be.
Exactly.
I would like to say, like, straight up before we start, this is a terrific book on audio. I find this book very deeply comforting. I read romance. There's a lot of different like romance moods that I have. And reading this book to me is like, and I say this is like the greatest compliment. It's like getting in a bath, right? It is deeply, this is a comfort read to me. I find being with Rhys Winterbourne, who knows what he wants and isn't going to let anyone get in his way. You know, I find this portrayal of insta-love to be very compelling, and I'm a person who kind of likes insta-love as a trope. I know a lot of people don't, but I think it's in some ways interesting to be like, okay, well, I've put them on page. I've made him instantly fall in love with her in a previous book. Now how am I going to sustain this for 350 pages? And then it breaks a lot of, like, my personal romance rules about what I like.
Okay, so
the exception always proves the rule.
All right, we need to talk about me, though.
Okay.
Because, so I have not read this book until literally this morning I finished it. And it's amazing to me because when you read a book that literally everyone has read before.
And loves, right.
And loved. And, like, you know all the quotes, right?
Yeah.
Like,
minutes.
I mean, I was just waiting for them all to happen, right? And so what's fascinating about that is that you start to paint a picture in your head of what you think this book will be,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're me and, like, a Kleypas evangelist, right? And so it's like when you basically cut your teeth on Devil in Winter and Dreaming of You and, like, have read every one of her books up until the Ravenel or the Ravenel. Is it Ravenel or Ravenel?
Well, according to Mary Jane Wells.
What does Mary say? Mary Jane.
The Ravenels.
Okay. So once you've read every book she's ever written, historical and contemporary, and then you stop, right? Because now I've vaulted the series. And I vaulted the series at this book because the setup for this relationship was so, like, powerful in Cold-Hearted Rake. Like,
yeah.
It is one of those situations almost in, again, the magic style where there's a secondary love story that, like, almost overpowers, like, the primary love story because it's so electric. And, or at least for me, it was. You have this, like, you don't know what the book is. You just know when the quotes come, right?
Right, right, right.
So what's fascinating about this is that then I read it, and it is nothing like what I thought it was going to be.
Isn't that fascinating?
And so, which was like shocking to me and surprising in like a really cool way because, you know, Lisa can still surprise me, which is great.
Yeah.
And I have lots of thoughts about why maybe this book is the way that it is. But yeah, it's structurally
so really fascinating.
Different than everything that came before it with her.
Yeah. So I reread this week by re-listening, right? Mm. I was kind of like, okay, I mean, just also because I'm broken. Although everybody, I have my splint off and now I can use both hands and that's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
I could show Sarah my scar right now. It's really gnarly.
Yeah.
You want to see it?
Is it hot?
No, it's gross. Look.
Are you sure? I'll be the judge of that. Ooh. It's pretty hot, you guys.
Yeah. I think I'm going to need a new tattoo, everybody, to go over whatever that scar is. I am a romance hero now.
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Sure. Okay. So here's what I was thinking about, actually, as I was listening.
Tell people you got it in a bare-knuckle fight.
I mean, sure. Somebody.
Obviously.
Yeah. With a shoe at Nordstrom. I'm going to say one thing, and then we can talk about the structure. One of the reasons this book works for me is because it is deeply romantic.
Oh, my God. It's so romantic.
Him sending, you know, like, crates from Winterborne's and building her a glass house on top of the store and sleeping with her stocking under his pillow.
He dislocates his shoulder and then is like, his first thought is like, I better get a lawyer because if I have been harmed, like seriously,
what
poor
about
Helen?
Yeah.
And then he just signs away his entire fortune to this woman. It's amazing.
Regardless of like anything else, I really think that's probably why I love this book. Like, there's no grand gesture at the end. Every gesture from Reese Winterborne is a grand gesture. And I think that that is deeply romantic. And romances aren't always romantic, but this one really is. And I think that that's part of what I find so lovely about it.
Yes, but somehow it is romantic without them really needing to be on the page all the time together, which is in light of our conversation last week about beginnings when we were like, oh, you know, romance is turning into this kind of this genre where, you know, if the hero and heroine aren't on the page together a ton, the book isn't as successful. And here's the truth. They are on the page together for the first, like, what, 60 pages? And they bang. Like,
oh, yeah.
In that period. I mean, like, it is hot. It gets immediately to it. That's super rare in a historical. Mm-hmm. It's very rare in a Lisa Kleypas book. Like, it's a really interesting structural beginning.
Yes.
But then the deal, we'll talk about the plot just quickly. So Helen turns up at Winterborne at the department store. She asks to speak with him. She says to him, I made a mistake. I didn't mean for you to get it pushed away. I was just a virgin and nervous and weird about kissing, and I've never kissed anybody before, and you're, oh my God, you're
right.
You.
Right.
And I mean, same, Helen. So this all happens, and then she says, so I want to marry you. Like, I want this to happen. And, you know, for a heartbeat, he's like, oh no, you couldn't possibly.
Right.
And then, boom, he's like, great, so here's the way this is going to work. You're going to need to get ruined. we're going to do it. And then nobody will be able to tell us we can't get married because he's like some Welsh son of a grocer. And she's now like a Ravenel. Like she's connected to, you know, old money, old aristocratic money. So she's like, well, couldn't we just elope? And he's like, no, we definitely need to bang this out.
Well, because he's like,
I want a church wedding.
Yeah. I want people to know that you came willingly and I didn't coerce you and all that stuff, right?
And they're like, the like billionaire son of a Welsh grocer, self-made man, wants to prove to the aristocracy that like he can be, like he too can enter their ranks. So she's like, well, I guess if we have to do it, I guess we'll do it.
I want to talk about that scene later because I am really
We're going to cut.
We'll go back to that. Your
I'm
plot summary.
The plot. Yeah. Fine. But then she says, okay, but we can't get married fast. We have to get married 5 months from now because I'm in mourning and also, I don't know, other romance reasons. And he's like, well, basically, yes, this is the biggest romance reason because this is what the plot is, everyone.
Yeah.
So, and Reese is like, what? No, 5 months. It's a little bit of an echo of Sebastian St. Vincent, who is now Kingston. But at the time, he was like, I can't not have sex for 5 months. What are you talking about?
A man's natural urges, Sarah.
But different, because Reese is like, I can't not have sex with you for
right.
5 months, right? Reese, from this moment on, will never notice another human
No, never.
Woman, ever. Like, no. They're just, they're unnecessary. So now there's this 5 month break, and they have to just kind of like exist in this world together without, like, what I love is it's sort of like, well, if she gets pregnant, we'll get married.
We'll figure it out then. Yeah.
But like, it's basically going to be 5 months. And then these two idiots, I mean, they're banging all the time. It's a miracle she doesn't get pregnant. But so what's amazing about it is then there's sort of this like push-pull. It's really a book of, it's a very quiet book
yeah.
in a lot of ways, with the exception of, you know, the building falling or the, you know, suddenly there's like a orphanage situation. Like there are, and I think that the structure of this book is so, when you said to me, it feels like getting into a bath.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense to me, because if you need just that like beautiful, romantic, soft, comfortable, certain read,
yes,
this is that book. There is never a moment where you think these two are not going to end up together. And that's wild to me.
I very much believed Helen thought maybe they wouldn't get together. And I think that's the only reason it works.
Yes, absolutely. That is the only reason why it works. And this is threading the tiniest needle.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, do not try this at home. You are not, this is a professional driver on a closed course. This is Lisa Kleypas
yeah.
somehow convincing us
yeah.
that this idiot heroine could possibly believe that Reese Winterbourne would ever let her out of his sight.
And I think I paid a lot more attention to Helen this time around when I was yeah. like listening, because I was like, okay, so basically this book has like three acts, like very clear three acts. Yes. I mean, right? You get to the end of chapter 11 where, right, she's been ruined. She kind of figures out she likes shocking people, right? But she's still so sheltered, and they're going to go back to Hampshire, and it's going to be 5 months. And then act two is she discovers she's known for a long time that her mother had had an affair out of wedlock, but she discovers that her real father is Albion Vance. Kate made a joke this morning about Albion, and I didn't know what it meant. Apparently, it is slang for Great Britain.
Yeah, it's right? the original name for Britain, for England.
For England, right? And I was like, oh, of course he's named Albion. Duh. Thank you, Kate. And her, like, very real dilemma, it seemed real to me of, like, I should tell him the truth. And everybody around her being like, that's not a good idea. And I like want to talk about that. And then the third act, which is essentially like the orphanage movement.
Yeah.
Right? The real drama.
It's when things happen.
Yeah. So one of the things I was really fascinated. Okay, everybody knows I like a heroine backed into a corner. So Helen finds her mother's diaries and she's like, I know now who my father is. And then very quickly, of course, it's revealed that this is Reese Winterbourne's, like, most hated.
I mean,
like,
the only man he's ever noticed because he's so busy noticing Helen.
Right. He's like, I fucking hate this.
Notice Helen and this other guy.
And this guy, right? Albion Vance. And so the thing that I found myself really fascinated by is, okay, so Helen is now told by multiple people, Lady Berwick, and also by the valet, Quincy, right, that she should under no circumstances tell him the truth.
Listen, here's what I'll say about all of this.
Yeah.
Sometimes no new friends is an important piece of the puzzle in life, and you should trust only the people who know you best in the world.
Yeah.
Because Helen takes the advice of these two people— like, who obviously have their opinions about this whole situation. I mean, Quincy has witnessed Reese being, you know, a grumbling man about Albion Vance.
Yeah.
And Beric, who is Albion Vance's aunt,
yes,
and knows how terrible this man is, who's right, going to inherit an earldom, by the way, is like, hey, listen, you need to watch yourself because he's going to inherit an earldom, and you can't just,
yeah,
like, you can't just you can't just feel the way you feel about him. Like, this is a person you are going to have to negotiate in the world with.
Right.
And so Beric is very concerned about appearances, and Quincy is very concerned about, like, what he knows to be true about
the Reese. Right, the kind of man he is, yes.
Which is such a romance hero moment. It has that sort of just slight echo of Lord of Scoundrels, where we see Dane through all these other men,
yes,
in his orbit.
Yes.
And in that, and so we get a sort of different, he's refracted in a different way through these third parties.
Yeah.
Including Devon, Severin.
Yep. Sure.
You know, and others.
Well, and I think that that's the part that, like, Fernsby, right? His secretary.
Awesome secretary.
Right. And then the doctor.
Gibson.
Right. I mean, Dr. Gibson, but also his doctor.
Oh,
the other doctor, right?
Fernsby's boy.
Yeah. Fernsby's boyfriend. I've read a million historical romances, obviously. And the plight of women, like how powerless they really are in the face of society, has always been, like, sort of shown to me essentially at, like, the beginning of a woman's life, right? As she's entering the marriage market, you're good for one of two things, right? You're good to essentially be a breeder or to, like, bring money either to a good match or extract money outright, essentially, and save the family. And I was really fascinated by Lady Beric's fears about what the end of her life would be like once her husband died and she was going to be at the mercy of this awful man,
mm-hmm,
and how little leeway she really knew she had. And I think that's part of the reason. I think even though, like, the pool, like, the surface of this was so placid in a lot of ways, I think it's really masterful at showing, like, the machinations underneath for how
motivation,
all of this really is working.
Yeah. I mean, motivation is so critical in every, obviously, in every book,
yeah,
for every character. It's extra critical in romance because we're sort of constantly attempting to hold two people back from being together. But in this book, it's so essential because the entire book hinges on Helen believing,
yes,
that these real strangers to her, I mean, she knows Quincy fine, but, like,
right,
but mostly these, like, kind of strangers to her are correct in their assessment of Winterbourne.
Yes. And of society writ large. Because a big part of the Ravenel's backstory, and one that I think Kleypas uses, like, really well as kind of throughout, is that these girls, right, Cassandra and Pandora and Helen, have been essentially, like, sequestered away in the Barbie dream house of Eversby Priory for their entire lives. And although they are part and parcel of the aristocracy, they are also complete innocents in the face of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they know all the rules and they know how they're supposed to act, but they have, like, no sense at all. They're like, of how it really plays out. Mm-hmm. And so this whole thing about Helen, like, sort of like figuring out at the beginning, she kind of likes shocking people, turning into the Helen who's going to go and rescue her half-sister from an orphanage in a terrible part of town,
mm-hmm,
with just another woman. And I believed it, right? I believed that Helen, who had been raised at Eversby Priory thinking family was everything, would make this choice at the end.
Of course.
Right?
Of course. I mean,
yeah.
Also, there is literally no Kleypas set piece more Kleypas set PC than that one.
Yes.
Right? Like
100%.
There is an orphanage, a child has gone missing.
Yeah.
And a letter is sent, a letter is received. The child is in a terrible location in London. And there's just, I mean, we must go there.
Yes.
And when we get there, suddenly we are going to see this heroine, like, spine stiff, totally, like, stiff like iron because of how she has changed through the love of the hero. I mean, it is so Kleypas.
100%.
It's her core story.
Right, right. But that's, I think, the part where she makes it look really easy, right?
Oh, yeah. Because you get there, and if, again, professional driver, close course, because if you get there in the hands of a lesser writer, you're like, what the heck is happening here?
Right, right.
But, like, somehow she has threaded this needle so perfectly that we believe that all the whole book has been coming to this moment where Helen comes into her own.
Yes.
And so when you say that you read this book thinking more about Helen on this reread, so I've only read it once, right? I haven't had a reread. Right. So Rhys is like, he's like the fucking
larger son. Than life.
It's
like
impossible to, it's impossible not to look at him. And as we're talking, I'm realizing that like, Lisa's so smart because he's not on page with Helen very much. Because
he sucks up. I mean,
because he takes up all the air.
Let's be honest, though. If I mean, this is.
But when Helen is alone.
Yes.
She's an orchid, right?
Right.
Sorry, go on.
Well, I think, like, it's not a problem, but like, this is. If it is a problem, it's a great problem to have. Every Kleypas hero is like this, right? Like, I mean, Derek Craven and St. Vincent and Rhys Winterbourne and Wes Ravenel.
Derek Craven sucks up all the air in the room. Like, Sarah's really powerful.
Yes. I mean, I like Sarah fine. I do. But I love Derek Craven. Right? I like Evie fine, love St. Vincent, right?
Lisa loves her heroes.
Sure.
She loves her heroes more than she loves her heroines. It's just, like, it's just true. It's obvious.
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm not saying,
No. Some of us are hero writers. Sure. Some of us are heroine writers, and some of us remarkably do both, and I don't know who those people are. But, you know, Winterbourne, like you said.
Yeah.
He eclipses everything when he's on the page.
Right. And I think that if you know that.
So we have to see her alone.
We have to see her alone. And we have to give her a journey that is, I mean, I think it's really also, it's very interesting because this, again, this reveal that she has known for a long time that she is not actually a Winterbourne. And her, like, sort of thinking about what that might mean for herself, the kind of person she is really fascinating to me because the Ravenels.
She's not actually
Ravenel. She's not a Ravenel. The Ravenels are so, like they're, like, a story out of legend in England, right? Like, every Ravenel is hot-tempered, like, right? Like, they're going to.
Weird.
And, right? Like, just, like, like, just full of fury and fire. And I think that then when you get Helen, who's sort of, like, missish, like, literally at the beginning, right?
Well, she's very different than those girls.
Very different. And at first you kind of don't pay attention to it as much in Cold Hearted Rake, but, you know, you really see it here. And I think I'm going to say some real English teachery. It's fine. I found myself a lot thinking about the name Helen, which was – when I was a kid, I think my grandma had a friend named Helen, maybe, or something. And it was always like a real old lady name to me. I mean, I'll be honest. No offense to all the Helens out there. Because, of course, you are also named after the most beautiful woman in the world, right? Helen of Troy. And I found myself really thinking about, like, one of the things I've never understood, because I'm not as steeped in Greek mythology as some folks are, is, like, why was everybody going to war for Helen of Troy? Like, right? Like, what did she – I mean, so she
surely
was pretty.
Someone else looked great.
Yeah, right? Exactly, right? Like, all these men really went
Helen
to war.
Helen of Troy is a 10, but you have to go to war for her.
For 10 fucking years, right? And then takes another 10 to get home. What were these men doing? And I did find myself like the
yourselves a nine. Yeah,
the first time I read this book, I was all Reese Winterbourne. It took me a long time to be like, wait, what does Helen mean to him? Right? It's obviously the entry into society. It's her care for him, right?
That's all Reese. I mean, for me, it was, and this is again thanks to Cold Hearted Rake, because I actually think without Cold Hearted Rake, this book probably reads very differently.
Yes.
Because the immense kindness that she shows
him
to him in that book, coupled with that very beginning. So, all right, I'm gonna say a thing, and then we need to put a pin in thing and talk about it later. But coupled with that moment about the diamond, like, yes. I don't want the diamond.
Yes,
I want this like other. I want this other ring. Like, I want a moonstone. I want, you know, whatever. And these kind of moments where he sees that she doesn't want him for the thing that he perceives as his only value and that the whole rest of the world perceives as his only value.
Yes.
And he's so shattered by this. Mm-hmm. That's all she is to him. She's just pure kindness.
Yeah. She wants him for him. You know, that's deeply romantic, Sarah.
I know it is. I know.
This week's episode of Fated Mates is sponsored by MJoy.
This is really cool. MJoy is a sexual well-being audio app for women. MJoy believes that all women should have access to sexual education and sexual therapy and gives us access to a huge library of audio guides, well-being tutorials, and erotic stories. You can download MJoy today to learn how to climax consistently, accept your body, and improve your relationships.
What's really cool is all of MJoy's content is scientifically backed and created by a team of sexual health experts, and they release new batches of audio erotica every single week. You can find MJoy on the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store, and as a special offer to our listeners, you are able to get a 14-day free trial to MJoy using the link letsmjoy.com/mates. That's E for erotic, M for J for joy. And you will need to use this link. There's no way to enter the code right into the app. And since all of MJoy's content is scientifically backed and created by a team of sexual health experts, and they release new batches of audio erotica every week, this is an app that you are going to want to check out as soon as possible.
Once again, that's letsmjoy.com/mates. And thanks to MJoy for sponsoring the episode. So can we talk about talismans, though?
Yes.
Because we've talked about this before on the podcast, and people often message us and say, like, you talk about this when you talk about Lisa, but could you, like,
say more,
explain it? And then there's never, like, a good time to talk about it. So let's talk
here
about
we are.
It's a perfect time. In my view, all romance novelists have, like, a tell. There's, like, a fingerprint in all of our books. And if you've read, you know, 25 Sophie Jordan books or 25 Kennedy Ryan books or whatever, there's a fingerprint. There's just, like, the thing that you see us use again and again, or the thing that we clearly love again and again. What Lisa does, I think, better than almost any of us is use objects as representative of feelings or themes or,
like, you know, state of their relationship.
Exactly.
Right?
And so, and there are so many in this book. There are so many items that appear that are, like, really beautiful talismans that represent much more than what they seem on the page. The ring, of course, you know, and it's sort of obvious what's going on there, like,
right,
you know, but also in Cold Hearted Rake, and then through this whole book, the orchid,
right?
The orchids are notoriously difficult to keep alive. They're, like, impossible
to keep
flowering. I know.
Right? I've killed a lot of orchids.
I've had one that has that flowered one time and has had beautiful green leaves for years and has never flowered again. And Christina from Christina Lauren and Kate Claiborne's dad have both tried to help me. like make this thing flower, and it just won't do it, right? But so orchids are notoriously difficult. So is Winterborn.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
And so is Helen.
Yeah.
These are two characters who are very it is very difficult for either of them to either be protected, cultivated, or for them to grow into their full
bloom,
most beautiful being.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of, there's another one that I marked.
Well, but I mean, I think, like, I don't know what else was on your list, but, like, this thing about, like, her bustle, this business about...
The stockings,
right? Like, her clothing.
Clothing in general?
Yes.
It's funny, because in the author's note, she talks about research and clothing, and she talks about the bustle. But this book, almost more than any of her other books, really, like...
Yes.
Really sits in clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the clothing, Helen's clothing, and then the clothing for the child, for Charity.
Yes. Right? Well, and I think, so I found myself, I mean, obviously thinking about a lot of that
stuff. Oh, the peppermints.
Too. The peppermints, his peppermints, right?
Which are a treat for somebody who never had access, right?
Lots of baths in this book, which maybe is why I think it's like a bath. There's like a
lot. Also, there's this like sense of, I mean, there's so much money in this book.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really fascinating because Lisa loves money, right? She loves like.
Don't we all?
I mean, we all do. But Lisa loves like heroes who own shit and build shit and sell shit. Like,
oh, yeah.
She likes men who are men of business.
Yes.
Right?
Industry. Yeah.
Yes. And it's really fascinating because I don't think, like, I thought we'd done this, like, with Harry Rutledge in the, mm-hmm. you know, in the last series. I mean, that's your vault.
I have not, yeah, series. I've vaulted the right. Hathaways.
Like, I thought we had, like, gotten to peak industry in the last series. And, like, we've seen, you know, McKenna. We've seen railway men before. Like, there are also, like, we've seen money before. But, like, wow, does Winterborn have money?
Well, and Winterborn knows how to spend it. I mean, he invents like a glass house on a roof.
Yeah, a greenhouse, a roof, right? A rooftop greenhouse. And like, it's just a sort of the moment, like when he's like, we're going to go get married, right? Like, we're going to finally, these two idiots are going to go and like get a special license and get the hell out of here and get married. And he's like, take a note, Fernsby. And he needs like 7,000 items packed into his private railway car.
And it's like, just get it done.
Yeah. And he's like, money's no object, obviously. And it's fascinating because it feels great in a way that it doesn't feel great always, like with a billionaire.
Right. Well, and I think that that's because he recognizes that her clothes are patched, right? That they're like older, that they're out of date.
Yep.
Right? But he also, like, the part where he essentially, like, lures Lady Barrack into the store with the promise of gloves, even kangaroo, right? Right? Like, this is a man who can, but he also is, like, so deeply familiar with, like, the wares in his store.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the part where he talks about, like menstrual products.
Yeah. Oh, I love that bit.
We carry them in the pharmacy, or
and I love it. At one point, Helen says to him, "You know a lot about women," and he says, "I know a lot about what women buy."
Yeah, and I think that's part of why he is deeply familiar with it because it's how he has
it's business.
Yeah, it's business. He's right there in it. Right, every part of the store is under his control. I also think it's because he's deeply democratic in, like, who he hires, right? Like, mm-hmm. he has women working for him. Fernsby was going to be turned away, but he hired her. He's willing to hire Garrett Gibson. He admires and understands hard work, right? Mm-hmm. He's picking off the best servants from, like, you know, old wards, right? Who, like, can't afford to put them, you know, keep them in employee anymore. It's really interesting, but...
But also, it's a perfect example of, like, really strong character work.
Yes.
Because the fact that he is so good at spending money, mm-hmm. right? That he knows the inventory in the store, all of the stuff that you just said. What it does is underscore just how out of character and important it is when he takes an afternoon off.
Yes.
Or clears the calendar for a week to go see Helen. Right. Like, and like, look, you could do that in a book and just like write it. Right. You could write the sentence like he'd never done that before.
No, but we understand.
In fact, like it says, I think Lisa does write something almost identical to that when he takes that afternoon off. He'd never asked for that before. But there's a difference between like telling me that.
And showing, yeah.
And then showing me like how much he works.
Right, right. And I think that's also the part, we did not get the tragic story of his friend Yon, I don't think that we would really believe how long this would last, because it would be very easy to believe that, like, once he, you know, sort of gets Helen and marries her, that he would go back to, like, working, like, this way. But this cautionary tale from his past, we have to really sort of believe that this has impacted him, that he will not make the same mistakes that his friend made when it came mm-hmm. to, like, having a happy marriage. He's, you know, and that's the part I think, again, like, she really cleverly anticipates what my concerns, right, about him would have been.
Yeah. Can we talk about community?
Yes.
Can we talk about this? I want to talk about how Helen, like Helen's broad community, and also I think this goes hand in hand with what you were saying about how in order for the conflict to work, like in order for the conflict in this book is not, as readers, we don't believe Reese will stay. Like at no point do we believe that.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
Like the whole conflict is that we believe Helen believes, right?
Yes.
And so what's interesting to me about this is so often when we give a heroine, particularly one like Helen, or when we see a heroine like Helen on the page, her community is like completely supportive mm-hmm. and like always in service to her best interests. And they sort of assist her in making good choices.
Right.
But in this case, and she has that, right? She has these like, she has Kathleen and... Mm-hmm. her younger sisters, and she's so, it's so obvious that she has this, like, beloved community of this sisterhood.
Well, and the servants and the staff, too, the housekeeper, Quincy.
Yes, everybody in service to her. And she has these other people, too, who are trying to, like, help in some way. And Reese could have been, because he is the son, right? He could have been a man on an island, but Lisa gives him some real people who care about him.
Yes.
Severin, Devin, there's this sense of like rich masculine friendship here mm-hmm. That's really great and again makes him somehow takes this like living god and like
makes him a little believable.
Brings him
right.
to earth. Plus, you get to see them all beating each other up.
Yes. Well, I think part of the reason it's particularly interesting, like, Helen's community outside of Quincy is women. And
yeah,
they're also, it's like women and servants. I mean, Kathleen is her sister-in-law, but, you know, is ultimately going to be powerless
as well. And, like, West a little, maybe?
West, for sure, right? But it's clear to her that she felt deeply betrayed by her immediate family, like her parents, obviously, and her brother even. Although there's like the one scene where he's the one that teaches her about getting her period. I want to talk about that actually a lot.
Oh yeah, there's so much body stuff in here.
I think it's one of the reasons she's actually pretty quick or assumes, and we believe that she would assume that Reese will not is not as like strong or steady is because she has seen the men in her world, right, except for Devin and West, and that's pretty recent, really not be as supportive as these other people, right? Mm-hmm. So you can kind of believe like that she would think, well, I'm not sure I can trust this man, mm-hmm. right? Again, I'm going to have to go and save this girl by myself because these men really can't be trusted when it comes to women's work.
And no one betrays her.
No one.
Like there is – because she also – I mean, it's fascinating. I think there's a really interesting moment where, you know, when she knows she has to go to the orphanage, she has this rich fabric of community, right? She could mm-hmm. go to anybody for help, and she chooses to go to Gibson.
Yep.
Which is smart because she's like, Gibson's probably been there. Like right. she – you know, there are lots of reasons why Gibson is a good choice, but she may not be like, she's not like the obvious choice.
Right.
Right. Except Helen's really smart.
Yeah.
Right. And at this point, Helen is smart. Her spine has fully grown.
Yes.
And she's like, she knows she has a goal and she's going to achieve it.
Right.
Right. And in that moment, she chooses, like, she makes a really interesting choice there, not just in Garrett, but also in, like, I'm going to have to live my life without Reese.
Right.
Because.
Sure.
So I might as well live my life about Reese with this child.
Yeah.
Who is important. She is my sister. And I think, like, there's something really fascinating there about, like, who, like, Helen kind of, like, gets to that moment in the third act and chooses herself.
Yeah.
Well, and in order to choose herself, she has to make – she's like choosing community. She's choosing like, I'm going to go get Gibson. But Gibson doesn't – like Lisa could have made it so that Gibson walks away from her and immediately goes to Reese.
Yep. But she doesn't.
No.
Right? And that's the thing. It's like I'm really fascinated by like watching women – and this to me is very reminiscent of the Hell's Bells. Watching women behind the scenes do the work that they have to do to like make it work for them. And now it's very different, right? This is so, I mean, this is like at a way lower frequency.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Garrett Gibson is going to be the one who can take me to this orphanage and can like fight our way out of there because she knows she has a fencing master or whatever. And I'm, and you know, and
right when she canes that guy in the groin and you're like, all
right
cool,
and,
Garrett.
And the housekeeper is going to be the one who is going to help me like
pack my bags
and get me away from here and my sisters and it was only after listing, you know, after a couple of reads where I was really able to like kind of look, see past the blazing sun of Reese Winterborn and see how interesting Helen's journey really is. Mm-hmm. And I especially want to now, so the first time I listened to this book was like high pandemic. I remember because I was working on a puzzle. I was listening to the whole scene where Reese essentially discovers that she had no knowledge of sex. None.
And he's horrified. He's like, why don't women talk
to each other? And I remember at that moment in time kind of thinking like, yeah, that's so archaic. And then really realizing like we right now are mm-hmm. living in a society where a good number of Republicans would like very much to put every woman right back in Helen's place.
Yes. I had that moment this morning when I got to the part where Kathleen says, did he spend inside you?
Yes. And she's like.
And she's like, what?
What?
And she's like, okay, we're going to have a talk.
Yeah. I mean, and I think I've told this story before. I went to Catholic schools, but read a lot of romance. I mean, I learned a lot about sex ed from romance. But remember my freshman year of college, I went to Villanova, so it was like a lot of kids from Catholic schools, that there was like a girl on my hall who had really no idea why she got her period. Like it happened, but she wasn't quite sure why. And I remember being like, what the fuck? And the fact that like this is 18 whatever and we are still here. And it's really easy to kind of be like, I don't know, just like sort of think like, oh my God, poor Helen. She had no idea. But like that whole scene, it's the most thorough, like deflowering of a virgin kind of scene that I have ever read. And I think it is really a, like a, I think it is like overtly political in its aims.
Yes, I 1,000% agree. You know, I've been reading, I've reread a lot of Lisa over the last few months. And I mean, if you want to talk about somebody who, a writer who has clearly been political about sex for a long time.
For a long time.
And it's fascinating because you wouldn't expect it, right? You just wouldn't. The books, that's not what the books are about.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think I talked about this when I reread Again the Magic recently, but in Again the Magic, the secondary romance is the hero of the secondary romance, his prior, he was with a woman who had an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I mean, and there was no judgment. It was like he, you know, she, she did not want to have the child. And so she had an abortion and it was botched and she died. And the heroine of that secondary romance had been pregnant and lost the child, had a miscarriage. And it was fascinating because I don't think I had clocked that on any of my prior readings.
Yeah.
And, but like, we're talking so much now about like abortion on page, like what, how we view about abortion, how we talk about it on page. And Lisa, I mean, the, you know, Evie and Sebastian have a conversation about IUDs.
Right. Like, like there are things we can do, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, it's really fascinating how much Lisa has talked about sex and autonomy.
Yes.
Over, you know, 3 decades.
And I think it's part, and the groundwork for a lot of this is in Kathleen's book as well, right? Who is like a virgin widow, which is the only kind of virgin I typically really like. But, you know, because I'm fast, it's like the what circumstances got you there. But, you know, she had no idea what was going on. And the way that like women's, and then her determination and Helen's as well, to make sure that the twins were not going to be that oblivious, right? Mm-hmm. Like that there was this sense of, we have some power to tell these younger women now that we are in charge of, that like we can, that like they should know things. And even Garrett Gibson, right, like is very clear about like what use charity might be later, right? Like what's going to happen to these girls. And I think like I really did. I think part of the reason I, on that, like at that point in time when I was listening to it and sort of had my like, oh my God, women back then just knew nothing, and then like really had to sit really hard with my feelings of like, well, here we fucking are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's another reason why I like really love this book, right? Like his outrage and sort of, like, I'll sort of tell you as we go along, and it's, like, kind of deeply, like, sweet and sexy and, like, but really, like, to have her be so, right, and when she says, like, it's the husband's job to tell her, right? There's a lot of women in our country right now who not only believe that, but have been taught that, and it's
so. But here's what I want to know: if it's the husband's job to teach them, how do the husbands don't know how the hell it all works either?
Right. Well, I mean, that's it. Like, or they don't care. They don't see it as a responsibility the way that Reese does.
No, I mean, because Reese Witherspoon. Why do I keep saying that?
Because of Reese Witherspoon's.
Yeah, exactly. Because Reese Winterbourne is a king.
This week's episode of Fated Mates is sponsored by Lucy LaRue, author of Making Her His, the first book in the Singular Obsession series.
So many of you guys have sent us emails asking, or messages asking, for stepbrother romances, and this one is for you. The hero, Alex, is in his 20s when his widower of a father gets remarried to a woman that he wants nothing to do with. But he, you know, over time ends up meeting this woman and her daughter, Ellen.
His new stepsister.
His new stepsister. And he can't help but sort of be drawn to this this girl who, and they become friends. They become like very good friends. He's 10 years older than her. And of course, once, you know, everything's fine until one day she's not a girl anymore. She's a woman and he can't help but notice. And that's that. He's done waiting and goes right for her.
Listen, the singular obsession title of this series is so great because it really hints at sort of that like forbidden taboo element that sometimes is just so fun to read about. So if you are interested in finding out more about Lucy LaRue, you can follow her on Instagram or Twitter at Lucy the Novelist. And Making Her His is available in print, KU, and audio. Thank you to Lucy LaRue for sponsoring this week's episode of the show.
Can we come back to Kings?
Yes, okay.
Because please, I'm just going to show you. Can you read? Is that backwards for you?
Yeah, it's...
Okay.
Yeah.
It says, Winterborne crushed by a building and survives! Exclamation point. King!
Exclamation point. Right. Thrown off a train. Survives.
I've said it before, and I will say it until I die, but romance heroes should be kings. And Reese Winterborne is a king.
Yeah.
I mean, he literally... He literally, again, so Kleypas, like the most Kleypas-y moment ever, where like suddenly this like slum that he's going to buy and turn into middle class housing for like employees of the Winterborne Corporation.
I know.
Is going to collapse and it's going to crush a child and he like is crushed by a building and like just dislocates his shoulder.
Yeah, sure. And he still goes.
And then the boy pickpockets. And then it's like.
I loved it.
And then in comes Gibson, who's an absolute delight.
You know what, like, it reminded me of? Like, that scene is where, like, Roy Kent is, like, given a Rolex to an ex-girlfriend. And then, like, it doesn't matter.
What I need. I don't need two ways to tell time.
And so Garrett Gibson comes to save him. But,
And wait, so you and I disagree about this.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
This again, is you guys, I vaulted this whole series, so I don't know what is to come.
Yeah.
So I texted Jen this morning, hey, is Garrett Gibson going to end up with Severin?
And I was like,
and
what?
She didn't reply to me. And then right before we started recording, I was like, is it going to be Gibson and Severin? And she was like, no, it's going to be Gibson and Ransom.
Yeah.
And I was like, but there's the moment where they're like electric together. What do you mean it's going to be Ransom?
And it's so.
And Jen was like, we'll tell them.
Yeah. I was like, so I think part of it is because then when Ransom and Garrett get on page later, that to me was more electric.
Well, that was also great.
Yeah.
But by that point, I'd gone 200 pages of like. Headcanoning Gibson and Severin, like having naked arm wrestling matches. And I was like, it's going to be the greatest. I can't wait.
No, see, no, I just enjoyed.
Severin ends up with Cassandra.
Yes, yes.
I don't even know. I mean, it's like a whole new world. It's like starting a whole new.
Yeah, maybe I just couldn't see it because I already knew. I also read this series. I am an out of series order reader. Out of order, whatever, however you'd say that. I never read series.
You're chaotic.
I'm a chaotic reader, which is why I DNF'd this the first time I read it. So I did not read any of these books in order. I eventually went to Cold Hearted Rake. Oh, no, I read Devil in Spring way before any of the rest of them. Then at some point went back to Cold Hearted Rake and realized I could read Marrying Winterborne. I think I read the whatever Garrett Gibson's is, something stranger. And then Hello Stranger and read Devil's Daughter last. I mean, I completely read this. Even once I start a series and I'm like, oh, I like this, I very rarely read it in order. So, yeah, I just all along knew it wasn't going to be Severin. So I think I just never had that.
Well, listen, Lisa, I mean, you got me.
So funny.
Anyway, if you two read Marrying Winterborne for the first time this week, would you please let us know if you clocked Severin and Gibson or Ransom and Gibson? I mean, obviously, it's set up that it could be either one, but I just want to know.
Interesting.
Who was shipping?
Who's shipping who?
Severin and Gibson. And all right, can we talk about how much fucking sex there is in this book?
Oh my God, so much sex!
It's like they do it all the time.
God, I loved it. I thought it was great.
I know, it's amazing. Like every time they are not on page together all the time, as we've established.
But when they are, they're doing it.
When they are, they're just I cannot keep their hands off each other.
I'm all over.
It is great.
It is great.
I love a heroine who's like, I like this.
Yeah.
I want it. I want him.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite scenes in this book is, and it's like deeply funny when Mary Jane Wells reads it, is when, he's, you know, dislocated his shoulder and then shows up anyway for calling hours because he told Helen he would, of course.
It's so great.
Right. And they disappear. And then we get Helen and Kathleen talking and Helen's like, I've been ruined. And Kathleen's like, what? Well, you know, we just have to really think about how we're going to tell Devin. And she's like, he's going to tell him tonight. And Kathleen's like, we have to stop him. And the fact that Helen's like, but how do you know he hasn't told him already? And Helen's like, well, we'd hear a crash. And then like, boom, all of a sudden, like that entire scene to me was like, so funny. I mean, right? Like, just really, truly funny. And then, like, Devin's all like, you know, like, my kinswoman's been defiled. And Kathleen's like, we fucked everywhere in Eversby
Priory. From here to Scotland. I mean, what on earth?
And Devin's like, well, that's different. I mean, I really did.
That was so cute when he said, that's different. I couldn't keep my hands off.
Yes. I did. I mean, I think that's...
I just wanted you so much.
Yes, right. And she's like, well, what do you think's happening with these two dummies? Right?
Yeah. I will say that I really love those. Klaipis always... She delivers that moment a lot with like a prior couple. Suddenly the POV sort of follows the prior couple for just a heartbeat. And we see them like...
Through.
In bed about to... Usually about to bang. And fine. They're like, what do you think about these two dummies?
I mean, I know. I love it.
So cute because we obviously know about these two dummies, but like it's nice to see them. It's like a little reader Karen feeding.
Yeah.
Wait, you have to tell everybody what you said to me earlier about the building falling and how.
Oh, yeah. So, okay.
Like what it means.
Again, professional driver close course, right? Yeah. Like, I really want to say this. One of the things that Klaipis does better than anyone is leveraging a completely over-the-top plotting incident, like a plot point, right? And one...
Well, it's usually not a plot point. It usually has nothing to do with the plot.
Right.
It's just like a thing
that happens. Some random fucking thing happens. And here's the thing. Like, and I've said this before. I bet if I, like, searched my own tweets, I'd said it. Like, in real life, random things happen. Right? In a romance novel, when random things happen, it almost always feels like an author who just doesn't really know what to do. Right? And furthermore, one of the reasons I feel that way is because almost always those random things that happen happen at a time to keep something from happening. Right? So it's this rom-com and these two people are finally going to kiss and it's 33% instead of 75%. And therefore the doorbell has to ring, right? Or the FedEx man has to arrive to deliver a package or, you know, something has to interrupt them. So the random thing that happens is clearly just designed to stop what should be, like, right, we all see the natural progression of the scene, but I have to stop it so random things can happen. With Klaipis, random fucking things happen, but they are never designed to, like, put a stop to a scene. No. Instead, it's just designed to, like, kind of throw everything up in the air and see where shit lands, right? So, you know, when Devin and Winterbourne crash in the train, there's no real...
In cold-hearted rake,
right? There's no, like... thing that's like, right, like hanging on this. It's just a thing that happens. Meanwhile, listen, one of my favorite parts of that book is Devin is like, Wes saves him and he comes out of the carriage and like all the servants and Kathleen are rushing down because they've heard that the train has crashed. And Devin staggers out of the fucking coach and just grabs her and kisses her in front of everybody. It's awesome, right? It's like, it's the opposite. Yeah. It's not going to stop him. It is going to, right?
It urges them towards something.
Yes, exactly. In
well, yeah. As it does here with the will.
Right, exactly. So when the building falls on him, the first thing he does is call his lawyer. and be like, I want Helen to get everything. And the guy's like, if there's a child, he's like, I want Helen to get everything.
Did I stutter?
Right? It's what I want.
And I and then because he's dislocated his shoulder, which is extremely painful.
Yes.
And probably could stand to go home and take a nap.
Sure.
Instead, no. He promised he would turn up.
Yes.
At regular calling hours.
Right.
At the Ravenel house. And by God, he is going to do it because he promised Helen
he would. Right.
And I'm like, yes. These men we're married to get a sniffle and take to their beds.
You know,
Reese Witherspoon gets. Reese Witherspoon. I keep calling him that.
I love it though, right?
Reese Winterbourne gets basically crushed by a building.
Yeah. Nothing's stopping him.
I will be at your home by 7 p.m.
Yes. Right. Well, 30 minutes to spare. But I think, I found myself really, even Helen finding, so Helen has known all along that her mother had an affair, and she is essentially packing to go to her new home, right? She knows she'll have, and so she's packing up her mother's diaries and journals, and then, there's like this little, suddenly I'm going to find something. And it's like she finally figures out the identity of her father. Like she just has a name for the first time. And I found myself thinking, like, this is a case then where it's not like at that moment she has no idea. She finds out after who Albion Vance is to Winterbourne. So I found myself thinking, like, why is it I'm okay with these like coincidental, like, boom, it drops into the plot? Because she's Lisa Kleypas. Right? Because that's it.
She's so good at the job. She's just better than all of us.
Right. And it's very difficult, I think, as an author to put a believable, like, random thing in. Boom, this happened. And I really found myself thinking so much about it because it doesn't matter what the boom, the thing that is that happened. It matters how believable the characters are. How are they going to react to this thing?
Mm-hmm.
It can't keep them from doing something. It has to show us who they are, right? And so yes. I found myself thinking, like, look, if Reese Winterbourne was going to fucking kiss Helen and the FedEx man knocked on the door, he would not give a flying fuck. He doesn't
need that package.
No, he does not.
He'll just buy another one.
And that's, I think, why I really did. I spent a lot of time thinking about why am I willing to buy a random, whatever? And it's because it's not about plot. It's about character, right?
All of it. The whole book is character.
Yes.
I want to talk about, just briefly, about the fact that Lisa does so much careful research about culture.
Oh, yeah.
This book.
It's really
fun.
And
in general, right, she loves to set heroes' pasts in obscure places. Not that Wales is obscure, but like Reese is Welsh.
Right.
And there's so much about Welsh custom and tradition in this book that is really interesting. And there's the moment where he talks right at the very beginning. He says he talks about the Oathing Stone, right?
Yes.
The marriage tradition in Wales. And it comes back at the end when they marry. But that's a real it's a real Kleypas fingerprint. These these little wedding traditions that are from all these kind of corners of the UK. But there is a moment, and I can't pronounce this word, but I'm going to put a TikTok in show notes. There's this moment where he talks about a very specific Welsh word that doesn't have a translation. And he talks about it's like how it's longing. Like
yes.
It essentially means like a longing for home.
Right.
And I sort of sat with it for a moment because for some reason, Welsh TikTok is on my For You page.
Nice.
Which is really very nice. But there is a Welsh woman who I guess like that particular word has been like co-opted recently by like influencers. Like,
oh, interesting.
American like spiritual, like, you know, sage your office influencers. And there's a Welsh woman who talks specifically about that word in Welsh and in Wales and why it is particularly Welsh, like how it is like built into this sense of like in Wales as independent and the Welsh nationality and Wales as a language or Welsh as a language, like the kind of identity
as an ethnicity
of being Welsh.
Yes.
Right. Yes. And we know obviously because history that, you know, Wales and England, it's not always great. and there's a lot of fraught stuff there, but it would have been so easy for Lisa to be like, he's Welsh. He says,
yes,
you know, he says these seven Welsh words and like that. So that's all you need to know. He's Welsh. But she so clearly did the research there to like honor that very particular and like kind of obscure thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Albion as the villain.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
I want to nod to that because I think you don't often see it. And it's such a historical thing for a book that feels very contemporary.
Yeah. It's historical romance with the history. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really love that. Right. Like, he really does feel like a man from a certain place. Right. And he knows what that is and is proud of it, but at the same time expresses, right, his mother's sort of teachings about never let them hear you speak Welsh. And, right, like there's all these, and, you know, how much he like admires his mother, but doesn't really want any part of her. Like there was no love from her. And I find a lot of that stuff really charming. I feel like we should talk about the end because it's, the best, right? Which is...
I mean, the last 100 pages of this book fly by.
Oh, yeah, right?
The third act is a really solid third act.
It's a barn burner, right? Mm-hmm. So Helen realizes that, you know, and again, romance reasons, kind of coincidence, right? Like his best friend that he was going to learn and not appreciate his wife, had committed suicide after his wife died in childbirth, and the child was not his friend's, right? It was Albion Vance's. So the child gets swept away to the orphanage, and Helen realizes that this is her half-sister, and she has to go get her. This is someone she can save. And, you know, Lady Berwick is very explicit with her. You cannot save this child, but you using his money can save hundreds of thousands, right? I mean, it's this really very romancy kind of, you know, one versus the many. And Helen's like, doesn't matter. It's this one. I got to go get her. And she and Garrett go down. It's this great scene. And, you know, her sisters, everyone helps her. And then she's like, this will mean the end of my relationship with Reese. He can never be with one of Albion Vance's daughters, let alone two. And Albion Vance at this point is going to blackmail Helen, right? Like, you are going to be my entry point into my sworn enemy's great fortune. And she's like, I can't do that. I think, you know, that's another part, right? Like, she's like, I would have maybe just gone along with it, but I cannot betray Reese to Albion Vance. Maybe I could have lied to him, but I cannot do that. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, I'm going to go to the train station and I'm going to go back to Hampstead and kind of get myself together, and we'll probably have to move to France and everyone will just think this is my daughter and, you know, whatever.
Because they look identical.
Of course. Romance. Romance.
I love it. It's my favorite. Romance. That's my favorite microtrope.
Like, oh, yeah.
How do we prove you're related? Because they obviously look identical.
Of course.
That's how it works.
And
obviously.
This child even recognized it, right?
Oh, the child walks out of her, like, gross room and is like, Mom?
Mom? Mama? Helen?
I love it.
And so she's at the train station and, you know, waiting for her train, and a nice old man is like, why don't you come sit in the back? It's going to be a while. Your train's delayed. And it turns out all of that was like, and meanwhile, it's interesting to me. This is all Helen's point of view. We don't, Reese's point of view for this kind of whole stretch is gone because it has to be. And Ethan Ransom shows up.
Does it have to be though? Because the one thing I really wanted
was, yes.
I tore through this.
I know.
Because it's great.
Yeah.
But I wanted McGreeve brain.
I
wanted the moment.
I mean, too.
Where Ransom is like,
sir,
don't freak out.
But today she went down
to the East End slums
and picked up a kid.
Collected an orphan?
Yeah. It seems fine.
Don't freak out. It's fine.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I will admit I kind of wanted that too. Maybe we could talk about why it's not there.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe we could have Lisa on and just be like, could you just write
it up for us and put it in AO3? Yeah. I will admit that if there's anything I wanted from this ending, it's this. But so Ethan Ransom then essentially she realizes she's trapped. Like, they've lied to her. And so he traps her in the room with this child, and then Winterbourne arrives. And
she thinks it's going to be Albion.
Yes. Right. She thinks it's going to be Albion, and she's going to have to face off and, like, kind of try and steal her child, like, steal, you know, Charity away.
How's she going to keep the child?
Right.
Safe?
And Winterbourne pulls her out of the room. I don't even think looks at Charity. Again, I only have eyes for Helen. And is basically like, what the fuck are you doing?
So, okay, everybody. This is where it happens.
Yes.
This is the moment everybody's been waiting for.
Yeah. Yeah. Where she's like, finally tells him the whole story.
I'm going to go to France.
Yeah. And he's like, try it.
Try it.
Try it. Not 5 fucking minutes and I will find you.
Oh, wait. I'm going to read it. It's so good. Hang on. I marked it. And it's all in one page.
Oh, yeah.
It's literally like, you guys, you've been quoting each one of these sentences individually. But it's literally like the
one page,
last paragraph of one page.
Because remember, at this moment, all along, we realized she was deluded to ever think that Reese Winterbourne would give her up for a second, right?
Right. I mean, there is a moment at the top of the page that's really beautiful where Helen says, like, losing you felt like dying.
Yeah.
And so I just couldn't.
Right.
I couldn't not lie to you. Like, I had to have every moment of you that I could get. And it's emotional and lovely.
It is.
And then he says, try to leave me and see what happens. Go to France. Go anywhere and see how long it takes for me to reach you. Not 5 fucking minutes. I don't give a damn if your father is the devil himself. I'd let you stab a knife in my heart if it pleased you. And I'd lie there loving you until my last breath.
Listen, I'm sorry. That's fucking perfect.
An absolute king.
Yeah, right? And then
I mean, he is the son.
When she wants to continue sort of like litigating this, he's basically
first
like—
First of all, what the hell, Helen?
I've had more feelings.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That is a great fucking line.
Yes.
I also underlined
I'm sure
that
you
line
did. Of course you did.
Because it's great. It's like the perfect line.
Yes.
Wait, where am I? Here it is. I've had more feelings in the past half hour than I have had in my entire life, and I'm at my limit. Yes. Listen.
You know what else he says? Wait, I want to say one more thing.
I probably underlined it.
She's like, you don't want to live with two of Albion Vance's daughters, right? And he says, every part of you was made to be loved by me. And I'm sorry. Game over. Now you know why people fucking love this book.
I mean, because right? He's great.
Yeah, and then he turns around and threatens to kill Albion Vance. Right? He goes right
Wait,
from.
Then we get to really the money for me.
Of course.
Because I've been waiting. I've been patient. We're 380 pages in. And I'm like, when is somebody going to get their clock cleaned?
Yeah. So he goes right from every part of you was made to be loved by me.
And then he describes in intricate detail how you would field dress
yes.
a sheep in
yes.
a butcher shop. And then he says, if you don't fucking leave England,
yeah.
you fucking asshole, I am going to field dress you like a sheep in a butcher shop. And the guy's like, oh, shit. And honestly, I assume he leaves.
As he should. We never
because,
hear from
him
again.
And it's great, and he sounds absolutely unhinged.
Yes.
And I'm like, come yes. to me.
This is when you really.
This is worth the price of admission.
I mean, it really. Well, and so I will admit that I re-listened and reread the whole thing to prepare. But when I just like fly into this book for comfort, it is pretty much from like the train station on.
Mm.
Right. Sometimes I go backward to her getting charity.
I would go to the orphanage.
Yeah. Right. Like the orphanage on. Right. But yeah, like that part where he is just.
I would probably. Yeah. I also would read the very beginning again.
Oh, yeah.
That beginning is really nice. Like that sort of. Look, how many beginnings start that way?
I also really love the scene where she gets a migraine at Winterbourne's.
Oh, yeah.
And Garrett Gibson gives her neuralgic powders.
Yeah.
And she gets like high on them and tells him that she wants her trousseau to be like a rainbow dress and unicorn shoes. And he's like. Whatever you want.
Cool.
Maybe we should postpone then. Back to the modiste. Because I love it all. I love it all.
Here's what I will say. And I said this to you before, and I'll just like say it here now too, to have it on the record. But I thought a lot while I was reading this about the fact that Lisa, prior to this series, had written contemporaries for a significant length of time.
Yeah.
Right? She like took a break after the Hathaway series and wrote, you know, a number of contemporaries. And I feel like this book has a lot of that in it. These kind of, and I think the softness of it, I mean, for lack of a better word, like the comfort of it, the fact that it's not like he is not like knifing people in the darkness, right? Like that, a lot of that stuff feels like she, over the course of her contemporary books, she found this new kind of elevated Kleypas voice.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think so. I think that's a very, I mean, I think that's a really interesting observation. Like how
like
does,
the years of learning how to write contemporary made this book
and this series.
I mean, I'm going to trust that you know this, that has made this book and series a little more grounded in reality than, say, like now Craven's Rubble and, or, you know, your half brother is mad with syphilis and shooting, like holding a gun on you. Like all of that sort of wacky stuff.
Right. Like it's interesting because the plot drama from earlier books was people driven.
Mm.
And the plot dramas here are like purely external, right? The train crashes.
To move
turn
the page.
Right.
To move the page along.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's so, I mean, she's so good at the job.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, at some point in the next month or 6 weeks, we will do our like best of 2022. And I joked around with Kate in a text and I said, I really feel like what we should do is do like the best of 2017. Because sometimes it takes a long time to really know what your true favorites are.
Mm-hmm.
And this book to me is a very good example of that. Like the first time I read it, I liked it a lot. Well, I DNF'd it. The first time I read it straight through, I liked it. I have come to love this book over time, right? To like really deeply like know it and love it and see things in it that the first time around I just like didn't notice or see. And I feel like that is the case. Like when we talk about our keeper shelves, right? Like as romance readers, I don't know what is going to be on my keeper shelf until it reveals itself to me, right? And sometimes that is years later, right? I go back and read something again, or I find myself really drawn back to a book that I read over and over again. Sometimes I do know right away. But I really do think that that's like the other thing that's really interesting about this book is I have come to love it more over time. I have come to find it deeply comforting over time. In ways that, like, the first time I read it, I liked it a lot, but I didn't, like, love it, right? And now I love it. And the same is true of many authors where I'm like, oh, yeah, I really like that book. And then a year or two later, I'm like, no, that one is actually my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that's like another thing that's just really interesting about like our two experiences of this book is the difference between finishing it today and, you know, having had this experience of like really having it be like in the ether of my romance brain for a long time and
yeah.
continually bubbling up for whatever reason. Right?
Yeah.
And that's unpredictable.
Absolutely. And I look forward to this book aging for
yes,
me.
Yes, right.
Yeah. I think, and I do think that there's so much in here. The way that you framed that was exactly right. I mean, this is a real nuanced book in a way that, like, it's different. It's
yes.
Like, you see Lisa... Lisa's doing a different thing in this book.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it was actually, I just want to say to everybody out there who was like, oh, Sarah hasn't read Winterborn. Oh my God. Oh my God. Like, I'm so glad that like, if I had to do it. Like when I finally got to this book, like I was doing it on the heels of like so much excitement
right.
about this book, because I think it made me really, like, sit with it in a different way.
Well, and I find myself thinking a lot about, like, the collective – like, when we collectively sort of adopt a book as being, like, meaning something.
Yeah.
I'm often,
being
like
–
Yeah, mm-hmm. right? Because that's, like, also a really fascinating process, right? Where it's, like, a book can get a lot of buzz, but, like, this book did not have this kind of buzz – before the pandemic.
No. And you know, right? That's the thing that a lot of people have talked about in general in romance. Like,
yeah.
Lord of Scoundrels didn't get a lot of buzz when it first came out. I mean, yeah.
It takes a time.
It sometimes does take a while.
Yeah.
You know, Julia Quinn talks all the time about how it took 3 or 4 Bridgertons before people started buying them. Like,
right.
It's a long game. It's a long view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because so much of what we do is like kind of like what's new, what, you know, like because we're
what's
just reading
right
so
now.
Fast. But like when you think about it, like, okay, if I read 150 books this year, whatever number, what are going to be the ones that really reveal themselves?
That have staying, staying power.
Right.
Right. It's that thing that we've talked about before about like the difference between something being popular and something being a legacy. Right.
Right?
Like there's a.
Right. Yeah.
Those are different things.
Yeah.
Not always, but often they are
right.
different things.
Right.
Anyway.
So.
Jen, thanks for making me break the glass.
Break the seal. We have a couple of other, like, I guess I would say one other big announcement we've talked about on social media is we have partnered with the Body Bookworms box. And we were able to pick a book that we just really liked, and it is Adriana Herrera's A Caribbean Heiress in Paris. And
oh,
it is
such a good book.
It's such a good book. And I mean, but you know, this is like a really fun subscription box. If you have not checked it out, we will put links in show notes. But if you don't follow us on social media, you might not have seen this. And I believe that it is available for pre-sale through the middle of October or until it sells out. So we will put the links for that in show notes, but it's always really fun. It's like a book. We wrote a little note. There's a faded mate sticker. There's some like cool swag in there. So it's like a really fun, if you're looking for a really, really cool, fun subscription box, this is the one you should check out. And we got to pick a, essentially like a portion of the proceeds go to a charity of our choice. And we picked the National Abortion Fund. So you're also going to like a couple of those, you know, some of those proceeds will go towards a really good cause and one that is deeply important to us.
Helping to keep abortion safe and legal. And for those of you out there who have been asking and don't follow us on Twitter or Instagram, Faded States is back. We are phone banking every Saturday between now and the election. We have some really, really important campaigns coming up. All campaigns are important, but we're going to do our very best to try and get Democrats elected to the House and the Senate this weekend, October 1st. We will be phone banking in my home district.
Which is so cool.
I'm very excited, you guys. Please join us. My home representative district, my house district, is the only red district in New York City. It is a deeply purple district. We can win it. And they've asked our help for phone banking. Come phone bank New York City. Who can say what will happen? But what I can promise you is that Max Rose, who is the candidate here, is a great guy. And I personally would be very grateful if you would join us on Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern. It's a Zoom. We'll put links in show notes. Check on Twitter or Instagram for more information. We'll also put a link to Max Rose's campaign so you can learn more about him. He's a veteran. He's a cool dude, and he's running against an absolute loony tune.
Yeah, so we have some other really cool Senate races lined up. I'm not sure of dates yet, so we're going to just keep it all under wraps, but trust me, you're going to want to stay interested. And if you are afraid of phone banking or nervous about phone banking, I'm just going to promise you it is the most fun you can possibly have phone banking. We make it really fun, really easy, and you will be there together with us on the Zoom. It really feels like you're in a room full of people phone banking. So give it a shot. You can come for 15 or 20 minutes or stay for the whole 2 hours, but we're really excited to be phone banking in Sarah's district this weekend.
And thank you to MJoy and to Lucy LaRue for sponsoring the episode this week. As always, the best way for you to support us is to support our sponsors. Otherwise, thank you all so much. Thanks for giving us more than 5 fucking minutes.
Amazing. Not 5 months, not 5 weeks, 5 fucking minutes.
That's right. Try it, Jen. Oh, also, do not read Tolstoy if you plan to get married.
Pro tip.
Well, that was Lisa's tip. Pandora and Cassandra have read Tolstoy, and that's why they don't want to get married. Because young women don't want to get married after they read Tolstoy. And look, would you?
No. I mean, Lady Barrack had a point. Okay. Have a great one, everybody. We'll see you phone banking this weekend.
All right. Bye, friends.